I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're taking a moment at the beginning of our show to remember Aretha Franklin, who died late last week. If you're a fan, there's a good chance you spent the weekend listening to your favorite songs. Well, Chuck Haddix of The Fish Fry here on KCUR did that too. He's also done some research into the Kansas City connection with the Queen of Soul. Hi, Chuck.
Well, hi, Gina. How are you doing today?
Good. How are you?
I'm great.
I'm sad that Aretha Franklin died.
Yeah, you know, she still had some good songs in her, you know, but pancreatic cancer can be unforgiving. And she got her flowers when she was alive, too. And what an accomplished vocalist. One of the interesting things that I think that came out of all this is she's been designated as not just the greatest soul singer of all time, but the greatest singer of all time.
I mean, I'm not going to disagree, but who designates things like that?
Well, the New York Times. they, you know, she was such a versatile. One thing about Aretha, you know, she's of course associated with her great soul recordings, but she could sing pop music. She could sing the blues. And when Pavarotti developed an issue and couldn't perform on television, it was Aretha Franklin that came in and sang opera. Very few vocalists are as versatile and have the kind of range that she had and the kind of presence. Both in the studio and on stage.
You recommended some clips, and we're going to get to them, but was there a Kansas City connection?
Yeah, Aretha Franklin. I'd always heard that Aretha played the Mardi Gras Club at 19th and Vine. And I was doing some research ahead of the program last weekend and I found out she played the Mardi Gras 1961. She had just signed with Columbia Records, and she was on a bill with Eddie Harris, and she was playing piano and singing. And then I came across an article from 1983 about her review of her Columbia recordings that were issued a few years later. And the author of the review said, gone are the swoops and the shrieks that we heard at the Mardi Gras Club. You know, at CBS, when she signed in 1961, they tried to turn her into another Dinah Washington, a pop singer. And they really kind of overproduced her music. And this white critic would have preferred that over her early sound, which was actually her true sound that she developed and cultivated in the 1960s.
That sound that really makes you feel every emotion that her song is taking you through.
Oh, yeah. And also in 1983, she developed a fear of flying after riding in a small plane that was a kind of out of control. So she canceled her appearance here in Kansas City, and the promoter had already sold a bunch of tickets, and so he was trying to figure out how to get the refunds to the people that bought the tickets. You know, this is pre-computer, and it was all complicated because Tiger Cardarella had been murdered, who owned Tiger Records, and it was a ticket outlet, and it had closed, so that was a very complicated situation trying to get the refunds out.
Dang. Man, that and the fear of flying, I hadn't heard that before.
Yeah, she wouldn't fly. She traveled by bus. And that kind of
limited her. From then on out?
Pardon me?
From then on out until,
yeah,
wow.
Yeah. She never got over her fear of flying. And that, of course, prevented her from touring Europe, where she was a big star, and performing as much as she probably could have later in her career.
Well, as I mentioned, you have recommended some clips. We've got them ready. Let's jog through them, shall we?
Sure.
Okay, this is probably, I would say, her most famous song. Feel free to disagree. A timeless tune.
Well, it is. And you know, what sets this apart from the soul music of the time, it's a woman demanding respect, dignity. It's also an early feminist statement. And she wants it when he comes home, but she wants him to give her respect.
What do you think about the covers of this song where men are singing it?
Well, it was originally performed by Otis Redding.
So his is the original.
Yeah, his is the original.
I wasn't sure who came first.
And then her cover really, but she makes it her own.
Totally.
You know, and the thing about Aretha is she gave a gospel fever to popular music, and that's where soul comes in.
Well, I want to hear another song, and first, why don't you tell me why you picked this one? It's Change Is Gonna Come.
Well, growing up in Detroit, Aretha came from a musical family. Her father was a very popular preacher who was known as the man with the golden voice, and he also had his national radio program and made recordings for the Chess label. And musicians and Martin Luther King, everybody would stop by Aretha's house, including a young Sam Cooke. And Sam Cooke in 1957 crossed over from gospel music to popular music, and then later he helped Aretha cross over. And this particular song, A Change Is Going to Come, is a civil rights anthem. But these African-American artists, these great soul artists, had to walk a fine line. They couldn't be too much in your face with the message, so the message is really buried in the lyric. You're talking about, I go downtown, and they say, don't you hang around, you know, and a change is going to come. And also there's a reference to Langston Hughes, I was born by the river, you know. And it's a civil rights anthem that was written by Sam Cooke, and I love the way Aretha does this.
Well, let's hear it. Change Is Going to Come.
There's an old friend that I once heard say something that touched my heart, and it began this way. Just like the river, I've been running ever since. He said it's been a long time coming, but I know my change is gonna come.
So, you know, as you listen to this, what is it? Are you able to identify what it is about her delivery that makes it so powerful to you?
Well, her vocal style, she's a very powerful vocalist, and she had these swoops where she would go up. And also, it's kind of music that really makes it's a very physical experience listening to it. It gives you tingles.
She has many of those.
Yeah. And, of course, you know, she really gives it a gospel fever. If you listen to Sam Cooke's versions, it's a little different than this one. But that's her little tribute to Sam Cooke there. And Sam Cooke wrote that after being denied access to a hotel during a Southern tour. And like, you know, the civil rights movement took the moral high ground by adapting spirituals to pop music, to anthems, to civil rights anthems.
Well, the next song we've got has a very different vibe. It's called Think.
Yeah, this is a song, it's kind of interesting. Aretha's career really kind of hit a rough spot in the 1970s when disco came along. And she really wasn't doing much. And then in 1980, she did a cameo in the Blues Brothers movie and admonished Matt Guitar Murphy to think before he leaves. And that really gave her career another boost.
Let's hear Think. Gotta let it play through that one high note at least. Is it possible to hear this and not dance? I just need to know.
No. I'm sitting here tapping my foot. I may get up and dance yet.
So what stands out to you as a common thread in Aretha Franklin's music? Because she does do so many different things, but you know it's her. The second you hear her, you know it's her.
Well, you know, she has a very distinctive vocal style. And when you hear her, you know it's Aretha. And I think that also, in terms of her music, I mean, there's a lot of great vocalists, but in terms of the themes in her music, one of them is dignity. You know, you've got to consider she was born in 1942. She was a black woman growing up in the South and in Detroit. And so she was demanding dignity. And her also, her music is very sensual. Songs like "You Make Me Feel Like a Natural Woman," you know, are sexual, but they're also sensual. And so her emotions are very raw, and that comes through with her vocal style.
Do you think that there's anyone carrying on her legacy today in Kansas City or beyond? Or is she just a one-time phenomenon, lightning strikes once, that kind of singer?
Well, she inspired, I think locally, of course, Ida Macbeth would be a good comparison. She has her own distinctive style and very powerful vocals. Mariah Carey, Whitney Houston, all of the R&B divas that came after Aretha, she inspired them to become vocalists, and they will tell you that.
What do you think it is? Do you hear when you listen to their music? Do you hear it, or do you just know that?
No, you can hear it. And they said in interviews, a number of them have said in interviews, they point to Aretha that made them want to sing. I mean, she was so popular and had such a long career, and she just inspired all these young women that heard her on the radio.
Well, Chuck Haddix, thank you so much for remembering Aretha Franklin with us today.
Thank you, Gina, for having me.
Chuck Haddix is the host of KCUR's Fish Fry, and he runs the MAR Sound Archive at UMKC. I'm Gina Kaufman. There's more Central Standard coming up next. There's a new hot spot for dogs and dog owners in Kansas City, the Bar K Dog Bar in the West Bottoms. It's a hangout for people who want to mingle and have a drink while their dogs basically do the same. We sent our brand new producer, Melody Rowell, to check it out. Melody just moved here from Washington, D.C., and riding shotgun the whole way here was Polly, a Dachshund Pomeranian mutt. But more importantly, a member of the household, like she's more of a roommate than a pet. In fact, when Melody announced on Twitter that she was moving to Kansas City, she did it with a picture of Polly in a Royals shirt. Do I remember that right?
Yes, that's correct.
So, yeah, Melody took Polly to the new dog bar.
Come on. Let's go explore. Yeah.
There's a kiddie pool full of tennis balls. There's a doggy jungle gym. There are, like, lots of lawn chairs. I'm gonna see if Polly wants to go in the jungle gym.
Polly was more interested in the many people there to pet her. The place was packed.
I mean, there's every kind of dog here that you can imagine. I'm probably seeing, like, 50 dogs right now. Probably more.
There's a menu with food for people and food for dogs.
Food for dogs, beef stew, chicken risotto, turkey and sweet potato meatballs, and then there's ice cream nuggets, cookies, pulpies, and beer paws whiskey biscuits.
So is this what it now means to be a dog lover? You order risotto for your dog and let her play on a jungle gym? I'm Gina Kaufman, and that's what we are talking about now on KCUR's Central Standard. You can join in at 816-235-2888 or post a picture on Twitter that tells us everything we need to know about your life as a Kansas City dog owner. We are at KCURCST. I'm here with Labe Dodell, one of the co-owners of the Bar K Dog Bar. Labe, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
What gave you the idea to open a place like this?
You know, we were basically solving a problem for ourselves. We loved our dogs. We loved socializing with our dogs. And we were always frustrated that the options were so limited.
Who's
so,
we?
myself and my business partner, whose name is Dave Hensley.
So what were you guys doing before you were running a dog bar?
I had a normal career, believe it or not. My background is as a lawyer, and I worked in the insurance industry. Nothing to do with dogs or opening a restaurant or anything like that.
But you were frustrated. Tell me more about your frustration.
It just felt like there was something missing, that there were so many people who wanted a social experience that they could include their dogs in. And we're fortunate in Kansas City to have a number of great public dog parks, and the dogs have fun, but there's nothing for the people to do. There's no place to sit, can't work on your laptop, can't get something to drink or a bite to eat. There are some restaurants that will allow dogs on the patio, but then it's sort of flipped. The people have a good experience, but the dogs are confined under a table on a leash. We thought, why can't we create a place where both the dogs and the humans have a joyful experience?
Do you have a feel for what makes the demand for this what it is in our time?
I do, actually. I think people are desperate for an authentic, engaged experience. People are feeling so disconnected these days. We have such a tense and acrimonious political environment, and I think people just want a joyful space where they can experience community with the people that they care about, which are their friends and their dogs.
Are you kind of saying also like dog as the great equalizer?
It absolutely is. It's a perfect icebreaker. We have so many friendships that are formed in our space where people then become friends outside of Barquet and see each other socially in other places. So it's absolutely proving to be exactly what you say.
So it's kind of about people meeting people.
It is. It's really community is the best way I can describe it. And it's such a harmonious place and such a joyful space. And when we were creating it, everybody would ask us, what are you going to do about all the conflict and the dogfights? And they're so rare because we're giving the people and the dogs a safe, happy, joyful place. And the energy is so positive and contagious that the dogs and the humans feel that immediately.
How do you make a safe, like a space safe for dogs to socialize?
It's a great question. And we've spent years perfecting our formula. We've very carefully thought through all the transitions from one space to another to make sure that the gate systems are effective, that there are double gates at every transition point so a dog can't escape, that there are no corners where a dog can feel trapped, that there are no hazards. And then I think once you give people that kind of a space, everybody relaxes and they realize that the details have been thought through, that it's a very mindful space, and then everybody can just relax and enjoy themselves.
So there is some indoor space and some outdoor space. Is that right?
There is. We have a 2-acre piece of land. It's right in Berkeley Riverfront Park, so it's an absolutely beautiful setting. We're under the Heart of America Bridge, so if it rains, like it has been doing quite a bit recently, you have a very large, dry, sheltered outdoor space. And then we have a 5,000-square-foot bar and restaurant where humans only can go inside and enjoy a bite to eat or a drink while their dogs play in our supervised outdoor space.
I would think that bad weather, or what humans usually consider bad weather, maybe more than dogs, would be your bread and butter.
You're right. And a lot of people say, you know, what are you going to do in the winter? What are you going to do when it rains? And the answer is, we're going to make a lot of people happy, because on a nice day, you can take your dog for a walk around the neighborhood.
And you love it.
And on a miserable day, you're dreading it, right? So we provide you a space where you can go on a cold day, on a wet day, and still be comfortable. And your dog, as you pointed out, couldn't care less.
But have you been surprised that, you know, you got the business model, like it all worked out, that the investments were there when you needed them to be? I mean, this is what might sound like a kooky idea, despite the niche there that it fills.
Yeah, I think goofy is very generous, Gina. I think a lot of people thought it was crazy, but I'm actually not surprised. I was a lawyer in the insurance industry, not exactly a warm and fuzzy kind of a profession, and I loved my dog. And all my friends love their dogs. And I would even suggest that, you know, it sounds crazy, but other than the bond between a parent and a child, I'm not sure there's a stronger bond between a person and a dog. People look at me like I'm nutty when I say that, but I would like to hear some other candidates. People say domestic partners or husband and wives, domestic partners, but I don't remember hearing anybody say that they ended up hating their ex-dog. So I think what we've done is created an atmosphere where people can celebrate that relationship in a welcoming environment that's thoughtfully designed for them.
Can you imagine opening a place like this a generation ago?
I just don't know what life was like back then. I mean, it seems like it would have been a natural fit in any era. I know there's a lot of talk about how these relationships have evolved and the dog is taking on a more prominent place in the family. And I'm sure that's true. But I would bet that if you go back in time, people had a very strong connection with their dogs. It just wasn't maybe as celebrated or acknowledged.
Well, Labe Dodel, thank you so much and congratulations on the success of your grand opening.
Thank you very much.
Labe is one of the owners of the Barkay Dog Bar. I want to bring in Julie Urbanek. She is an animal studies scholar here in Kansas City. And before we pick up on what we were just talking about with Labe, what does it mean to be an animal studies scholar?
Well, as an animal studies scholar, I'm interested in understanding the ways in which humans and animals share spaces, and also the ways in which human society makes categories around different types of animals. So if we're talking about dogs and something like dog parks, I mean, we're looking at a larger social transition that is more and more seeing dogs as direct members of the family. I mean, even the language we use to talk about dogs now is, you know, pet parents, fur babies, all of these kinds of things are a change in our larger social structure in terms of what it means to live with other species.
You know, I mean, just to follow up on the point that Labe was making, he says that, you know, people have always felt this way about their dogs. And I think that that is true. And, you know, that nickname, man's best friend, didn't just get invented yesterday. But I will say that the way that I loved my dogs growing up, which was very like warm and fuzzy and affectionate, I kind of feel like my parents were a little more detached. And that strikes me as a very common divide between Gen Xers and their baby boomer parents.
Well, I think that's true. And one of the things that animal studies scholars look at is we do look at those historical changes. And just an interesting side note is that the phrase man's best friend did come out of a legal case from 1864 in Warrensburg, Missouri, and with a dog named Old Drum. So that is just an interesting local connection here.
Wait, can you phrase. Say more about it?
Well, Old Drum was a dog who was actually shot by somebody, and there was a long legal case that went forward, and basically as part of the prosecution of this legal case, saying that this was man's best friend and that this was actually a crime, because the defense was arguing, well, look, this is just a dog. It doesn't, you know, what difference does it make, right? But this larger story became embedded in our culture. And as we all know, people who live with dogs, I mean, we do feel that they are, you know, our best friends at times.
But why would one generation relate differently to dogs than another?
Well, there's a lot of different reasons for that. And in Kansas City has gone through large periods of having different types of interactions with different species, right? I mean, when we were founded on a city that was based on the fur trade, a very utilitarian resource extraction. We then also have the resource extraction and use for livestock. And we, early on in our history, going back to 1898, we have the first city ordinances looking at how we should take care of dogs in the city. We have the founding of a humane society in 1883 here, which was actually doing a lot of comparative work, saying we actually need to prevent cruelty towards other species as well as to children or poor people or anything like that.
Was that cutting edge at that time?
It was part of a larger movement across the country and even in Western Europe, where you have a recognition of wanting to be part of a civil society. And that part of that was actually learning how to care for people. And as we became more densely populated in urban areas, the visibility of what was happening to animals or people just became very obvious. And so specifically in Kansas City, people like Lula Combs and Thomas Swope were actually instrumental in supporting a lot of that early work. But we have in Kansas City, because we have a very history of seeing animals as resources, that we do have a mentality of animals as property, as objects, that is a very long aspect of our history that simultaneously exists with people loving a whole variety of animals. So you can love a horse, you can love a cat, you can love your chickens, right?
But they serve a purpose.
But they serve a purpose. Dogs serve a purpose, too. They make us happy. They make us feel good, right?
And so they protect us.
They protect us. They do protect us. And, you know, they're there for us in many different ways. But that the changes for this idea of having a more than human family and really having that embedded in our culture is something that has happened simultaneously with sort of the removal of some animals from the city, all of people being packed in a city and not having a lot of access to the natural world. And so we're actually wanting to be able to take our more than human families in our private space of our home and actually live that out in the public space of the city. And so people are, you know, recognizing that dogs have experiences and that a dog that gets to run and slobber and eat ice cream, you know, may actually be better at home and in public spaces if the dog gets to be able to do that.
And that a dog wants to spend time with other dogs, with people.
Some dogs, right? I mean, not all dogs are into that. But yes, the idea is that as we recognize more and more that other species have very intense experiential lives, not to make them equivalent to the human experience, but to recognize that other species like dogs have needs. They have needs to be socialized, to exercise, to just sniff the air, right? And not everybody has access to a private backyard that can be fenced in.
Not everyone has access to a doggy daycare either.
That's very true. And that's, you know, that's a larger economic issue that goes on. And that is something that a lot of different people are working to address as well.
So what do you see going on in Kansas City right now with bars for people and their dogs, with doggy daycares, that everywhere you turn, there are dog bakeries, you know, and then that's on top of off-leash dog parks, dog walking apps, message boards, and Facebook groups for dog people?
Well, I think that we're just seeing the extent of that shift in what it means to be an urban area that actually consists of multiple species, right? People that are supporting dog parks and the entire dog economy are part of a perspective that's saying, look, cities are for more than humans, right? We live in a multi-species urban environment. How do we actually handle something like that? And there's a lot of businesses that are taking advantage of it, not only the dog park down there at Bar K, but you have Three Dog Bakery. You have Nudicles for, you know, that you can actually get testicular implants for your dogs and your livestock, if that is something that is interesting to you. You have FitBark. FitBark, that is a dog tracker. Well, you can get Nudicles because people don't want their dogs to be seen as sort of being emasculated, that there's a perspective that the dog suffers if you do something like that, or you don't want that to be a visible aspect of the dog's existence. So it's a very high return on that kind of business.
I had never heard of that before. When I think about something like the dog daycare, I think about economic change too, that the more households are either dual income households or run by single people who are just living alone with a dog, that people need to find a way to make pet ownership work when no one's home for most of the day.
Mm-hmm. And that's true. And dogs present, you know, they are a little bit more complicated in that arena than something like a cat that can stay home, that can use a litter box inside. Dogs do have to be able to go outside and do all of their business. And so how do you actually handle that? That means that dogs are, there's a need that dogs become more visible in our daily lives.
You know, as an observer, I do feel like doggy daycares are a sign of gentrification in a neighborhood. Is there anything to that?
Well, I think that there is, because you have to have disposable income in order to pay for doggy daycare. And it is not always cheap getting dog insurance, taking your dogs to the dog parks, having them birthday parties, buying them all their clothes. None of that is cheap. And so, you know, if you have that sort of extra income, you are able to do that. And you can look at the city and you can map out where are the doggy daycares. And they are in areas where people can, in fact, afford to do that, which presents a problem for people who can't.
Well, call 816-235-2888 to join this conversation, whether you're a dog person or just a Kansas Cityan with something to say about all the dog people in town. 816-235-2888. I want to quickly talk with Melinda from Lenexa. Melinda, hello.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to share?
Well, one thing that really struck me as I was listening to the conversation was the impact of leash laws on this whole concept of dog-human relationships. I was born in 1956, and when I was growing up, dogs just ran around the neighborhood, and and you just saw them everywhere and played with them and that type of thing. And then as I became an adult and had a dog, and I would talk with my mother, who was born in 1935, about walking our dog, she would just laugh about, you know, people having to walk their dogs and take them to dog parks. It was such an anathema to her. You know, dogs just ran freely and got their exercise that way. And I think that's really impacted the relationship. Your dog is with you much more than in the past, where you'd open the door, let them out, let them run around, and then they would come home at dinner just like the kids would.
Julie Urbanik, any thoughts on this?
Well, I think that's a great story about how we see the social changes coming into play. And I think that, you know, when we look again, it's sort of the city ordinance of the history of Kansas City. There has always been an attempt to actually control the dog population. You know, we had dog catchers very early on. People were supposed to get their dog's license. You weren't supposed to just let your dog run around all over the place. But because the attitude at the time was one that said, well, you know, whatever, the kids are running around, the dogs are running around, it's all just kind of a free range situation, if you will, right? And so we had changes that said, well, no, like, we don't want these dogs to be on the street. People are concerned, is my kid going to get bitten? Am I going to get bitten? You know, is some dog going to come and make my dog pregnant? So you just had a lot more concerns that came up as we moved through time.
Well, we've got a dog person here to tell her story now. Micah Hay, good morning.
Good morning.
Tell me about your dog.
Well, he's a four-year-old lab. He's 105 pounds, so he is a big boy. And he loves to go out and socialize with not only dogs, but other people. And he will let me know at the end of the day when I get home that that's exactly what he needs to do.
Can you tell me just quickly the story of getting your dog?
Yeah, I was going through a breakup, and my aunt said, let's focus on something positive and go look at puppies. I said, no, I can't do that. Of course, I went, looked at him, and was like, where do I write the check? And brought him home at 8 weeks old, and he's been with me ever since. And, I mean, he got me through a tough time. So, you know, when I come home at night, I know he's been waiting all day long for me to get home. And I just feel bad leaving again and letting him sit there by himself for the rest of the night. So if I'm going somewhere, I try to include him.
What has that been like for you?
It's been awesome. I mean, I joined the Kansas City Dog Club last January. And I've been active with that club. I've met a lot of great people. I've been able to network with people. Macho has a lot of new puppy friends that he likes to play with. If I go out of town or they go out of town, we have friends that we can take care of each other's dogs. And we know they're going to be in good hands.
What do you think of all the different, like, offerings and amenities that are popping up? Are there things that are super helpful and fun, and then other things that are pretty unnecessary, or you're into all of it?
I'm pretty much into all of it. And I love that all the different companies are kind of getting together to do fundraisers for the shelters and, you know, for other companies.
I'm curious about when you do go out and go places, do you have favorite places or, you know, reviews or recommendations? What are, for example, some of your favorite places to eat where you can bring a dog?
Well, I live in Parkville, so the easiest place for me to go is Chicken and Pickle. That's been one of my go-tos. And now that Barquet's opened up, we'll be there tonight with Networking for Dogs. They're doing a little event, so that's a really great place to go also. Macho loves the Tito's pool.
Wait, what's that?
It's a little dog pool in the shape of Tito's bottle. They sponsor it. And they've got, like, little cabanas and stuff for them to sit in.
And by they, you mean the Barquet bar?
The dogs can sit. Yeah, Barquet, sorry.
So then, do you have favorite dog parks or off-leash dog parks?
Yeah, Parkville has a nice dog park that has, you know, a section for the smaller dogs and for the bigger dogs. Besides Barquet, the dog club goes to almost every single dog park. Shawnee Mission is a really good one. They're closed down right now because they're renovating, but they've got a little lake entrance that the dogs can swim in with trails that wind up around the woods. Matcha likes to do that one.
Do you ever get mixed reactions from non-dog people for the level of involvement your dog has in your life?
Absolutely. A lot of my family and friends say, do you have a life outside of Matcha? Because I do post a lot of what I do with him because nobody really cares what I'm doing. But it's just really cute to see Matcha going on a pup crawl down in the crossroads and bark in the park and, you know, hanging out on a Saturday at Barkay, swimming in the pool. I mean,
do I understand correctly that some of your friends have tried to stage an intervention?
I mean, I wouldn't go that far.
How far would you go?
I don't know. I don't know. I just say, well, do you do things without your kids? I mean, do you leave your kids at home all day long, all night long? No, you want to include them. And that's what I do.
Well, we have to take a short break. In just a minute, we will take your calls and hear your stories. We are going to walk a mile in your shoes, Kansas City dog people. 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. We are back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard. We're getting inside the lives of dog people in Kansas City. I'm here with animal scholar Julie Urbanik and Kansas City dog enthusiast Micah Hay. And now I want to talk to some of you. I'm going to quickly hear from Ellen in Overland Park. Hi, Ellen.
Hi there. my main point I wanted to make was that I don't think that this is so much about a generation in the sense of caring about our dogs and having them completely a part of our lives. I'm 66 and I grew up with parents who were born in 21 and 23. And we had 9 kids and a tiny poodle who was part of our lives. And my husband and I had 36 animals in 35 years. Our animals were all a part of our lives. And in my family, every Christmas, everybody brought their dogs, and every party, we all brought them. But what happened, I think more than anything, is my parents were the ones who were creating the middle class. And the disposable income, particularly in large families, was not insanely wildly over the top as it is now. And so now, where we have less community connection, we have more disposable income, at least for now, in the middle class. We have to create community, and we have less face-to-face, hand-to-hand contact with humans because of our phones and whatever. We now, with this disposable income and lack of community, are creating these things, but definitely the connection to our pets was as real with many people. There are plenty of people who do not like animals anyway.
Well,
and aren't that
Ellen,
kind to them.
That is a super interesting point. I want to hear from Morgan, who has kind of a similar point to make. Morgan is with the KC Pet Project. Hi, Morgan.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
My point was I've worked at KC Pet Project for 2.5 years, and I've worked predominantly that time in the admissions department and now as lost and found coordinator. And we see a lot of animals who are coming into the shelter as strays because they are escape artists, meaning that they are able to jump a 6-foot privacy fence without issue. We see a lot of animals that are surrendered to our shelter because they are so anxious when their owner leaves them that even the most heavy-duty wire crate is not keeping them in. And so all these animals that I'm discussing here right now would benefit so much from a doggy daycare facility that they could be in during the day, monitored so they're not escaping, that they're not hurting themselves because their separation anxiety is so strong. And despite that there are so many more of these daily doggy boarding facilities, they're still so far economically out of reach for so many owners. Which is disappointing because a lot of these pets would be able to not escape from their homes or not have to be relinquished if they had access to that resource.
Well, Morgan, thank you so much for that call. This does, I mean, we got into this idea a little bit earlier in the show that the level of sort of, some people might say indulging dogs, but others just would say treating them kindly. It would have been considered extreme at one point and now has become mainstream, but I wonder how that does move the needle on financial expectations of dog owners. And I want to talk about that more with Michelle Rivera, who's the founder and CEO of Spay Neuter Kansas City. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, good morning.
So we're hearing a lot about that it's not a generational change in terms of how much we love our pets, and that, in fact, someone choosing to send their dog to doggy daycare doesn't mean they love their pet more. It might just mean they have more money.
Correct. We, you know, at Spay Neuter Kansas City, we have a lot of philosophies, and one is that we very much believe that the unconditional love, the animal-human bond, is strong even amongst those with a lower income or less financial means. Everybody's entitled to love a pet and receive that unconditional love. But I agree with Morgan, that lack of resources and access to pet-friendly attractions and other things other than dog parks for the lower-income people is limited in Kansas City.
Do you get the sense from people you interact with that it's getting harder for people to feel like they can afford to have a dog?
No, not necessarily. I think it's a perception that, you know, you see a few cases of abuse or neglect. You hear about people wanting to give up pets. That is a horrible situation. But we have over 24,000 pets come through our facility every single year in searching low-cost spay neuter or affordable vaccinations, and they love their pets just as much as anybody else.
What kind of change have you witnessed just in the relationship of how the typical dog owner in Kansas City relates to their pet? What kind of change have you witnessed since you started up your organization?
I don't know if it's so much change, because I think it's always been there, but it's a better understanding now of that animal-human bond, even amongst low-income families. We're seeing families whose pet is their only attachment to a family member who is a victim of violence or a shooting, or a elderly lady whose cats are her only means of communication and that unconditional love. She has no family left. And so we're hearing more and more stories about that and a better understanding that the animal-human bond runs very deep.
And do I understand right that there is some kind of food pantry, essentially, mm-hmm. for pet food?
Yes. So we provide all kinds of levels of service. But yeah, we have a food pantry program, and it's there to help people who might be in a temporary financial situation, or even some people are dependent on that food pantry to feed their pets, because if that wasn't there, I promise you they're going to be feeding their pets their own food. So we see a lot of that, and even in the homeless population, that they're giving up their own food to their pets.
Julie Urbanik, historically, how does this fit in? I mean, I assume it's always been hard to feed an extra mouth when that mouth, even if it's a dog.
Well, I think that's probably true. And people throughout history have, you know, had very intense human-animal bonds, just as your caller said. And people are willing to go to extraordinarily links to actually care for, another human being or another species. If the perception is that other species is actually part of their meaningful circle of love. And so, sharing food, foregoing medicine for yourself, people that are willing to actually lose home or lose access to an apartment and have to go live in their car because, you know, their apartment might not, you know, create a new policy where they can't take dogs or things like that. I mean, people are willing to go very, very long distance to care for those beings that they love. And we're seeing that publicly become more and more about other species.
Has there always been, it sounds like almost the idea of a social safety net for pets in this food pantry model, is that a new thing?
Again, we had the Humane Society that was established here in the late 1800s. And, you know, part of their mission was to provide care, to provide services. And they provided food, and they did that for both children and animals. They were also instrumental even in doing things like getting public fountains for the horses that were visible working animals in the city at the time. So that idea of helping people care for animals who might not be able to do that for themselves has always actually been a consistent part of the city's history.
That's very cool. Is Kansas City unique in that sense?
No, because there are people that are committed to animals all around the world and certainly all over the United States, too. So Kansas City is a particularly interesting story, however, because it does link itself in so many ways to all of these different kind of configurations of animal economies. So you have this longstanding undercurrent of caring for other species at the same time that you have these extractive economies of fur or the livestock industries.
What do you think of right now? You know, there are all kinds of trends relating to animals that go beyond the dog world, like the cat cafe phenomenon. What do you think about that, where people go to a cafe where they can just go and hang out with cats?
Well, first of all, my cats would not be able to participate in that cat cafe. They are three neurotic cats. but I do appreciate people's desire to interact with other species. And, you know, from a scholarly perspective, a lot of people think of that in terms of a biophilia, which is a term that means a love of life, and that it is actually something that's part of our human nature to want to interact with other species. And as urban residents, we don't often have the opportunity to do that. We can go look at animals at the Kansas City Zoo, for example, but you can't just roll around with a giraffe or a polar bear.
No,
right?
So I've never gotten to do that.
You've never, right. You're just not going to get a chance to do that. So how and where we get to interact with these other species is becoming more important. And, you know, in places like Tokyo, I mean, there's hedgehog cafes. They have really taken this idea of public space and animals in a very interesting direction.
Let's talk with Tina, calling us from Leavenworth. Tina, what do you want to share?
Well, I am new to Kansas City, sort of. I've been here about 6 years. And I came from Arkansas, and that's where I got my first dog as an adult. I grew up with a family. We had money, and our dogs were still just our dogs. So if a dog died, you moved on. You might have cried for a day or two. You get another dog. There was an attachment, but not like the attachment you see now. When I finally got my first dog as an adult, he became my very best friend and my world. So when I had to travel a lot, I would leave him at a place that was a doggy daycare and, a kennel, but they didn't put them in kennels until they went to bed at night. It was a free range, location. So when I moved to Kansas City and I lived in Shawnee for the first 4 or 5 years, I did the same thing. And, you know, in that area, I'm not sure if it's so much about the economic issue or the area, because in that area, you also have the dog parks. You've got the doggy daycares and stuff like that. I now live in Leavenworth, and I feel like I'm back to where I was kind of with my parents and as I was growing up, where dogs are just dogs. And not for all of them, but a lot of them, they have a job to do. And if they don't do their job or they're no longer able to do their job, they just get another dog that will do the job. And I think it's because it's a more of a farming community, maybe. But you don't see, I don't see the attachment in Leavenworth that I did in Shawnee and Overland Park. And you also don't see places that let you bring your dog to their patio or to the, you know, wherever you're going. You just don't see that kind of bonding and connection that you do in Overland Park and Shawnee and places like that.
I wonder what Julie Urbanik has to say about this. I mean, do different communities relate differently to their pets?
Well, I think that the difference, I mean, again, you're looking at a little bit of a difference between a rural-urban divide, although, you know, Leavenworth is not completely rural, but you still have, you know, possibly more of a utilitarian view of animals. And, you know, again, you see that in the language, that dogs are pets or dogs are there for our defense. They're not our fur babies. We're not their pet parents. There's a recognition that the dog is there. It's part of our life, but it serves a very specific role. And so, you know, in an urban area where, again, you have that density of people trying to live with their dogs, you're going to have different outcomes.
I want to jump in and say something. I mean, people might hear that as a more like cold kind of relationship, but I actually hear it also in this way of like there is a level of respect in understanding a four-legged creature as having a job and a purpose mm-hmm. that is kind of like yours to go out and get something done.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I don't, you know, there's, it's not a criticism of people that have a different view or see the dog as having a job or a purpose or see the dog as a pet or see the dog as, you know, a being that, well, its job is to live in the backyard and protect our house, right? There, it's just, it's a different sort of experience. It's a different sort of background that comes into play when you are, in fact, looking at this type of relationship.
Well, our time is up, but thanks to everyone who participated in this conversation. And keep talking to us on Twitter. We are at KCURCST. Julie Urbanik, animal scholar, thank you.
Thank you.
Michelle Rivera with us from Spay Neuter. Casey, thank you.
Thank you.
And Micah, hey, enjoy your dog. I'm sure you're going to go home and see your dog soon, right?
Yeah.
Okay, good.
Thank you.
If you missed anything on today's show, you can grab it later at kcur.org/Central Standard. That's kcur.org/Central Standard. Earlier today, we talked with Chuck Haddix about Aretha Franklin. And on Friday, we talked with Kevin Wilmot about the movie Black Klansman. This show is produced by Melody Rowell with Coy Duggar, Kathleen Pointer, and Suzanne Hogan. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer, and I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next. Don't miss it.